This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You know carbon is already too high in the atmosphere for our own climate safety. And perhaps you've heard the biggest and best solution is to put carbon back in the soil. But what are we supposed to do? Go shovel carbon into the lawn after work? Our next guest says organic carbon capture is maybe not a job for most of us, although we can help. In June 2014, I asked author and activist Courtney White about his book, Soil, Grass, and Hope. Now he's back with a collection of inspiring stories which point to fundamental answers. It's called 2% Solutions for the Planet. From Santa Fe, New Mexico, Courtney White, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm very happy to be here.
Just before we get to a whole slew of ideas for saving a living planet, how can you say just 2% of the population may be the key climate solvers?
Well, the book covers a number of practices that involve agriculture, ecological restoration, and things like that. And the 2% of the American population that could be the workforce for that is largely farmers and ranchers. And I think most folks don't realize that most of the food in this country is produced by just a tiny fraction of our population. So that was the idea behind that part of the 2%.
Yeah, it used to be about 50% way back in the day were, you know, farming and on the land. I wonder, wouldn't that number have to go up if we stop using so much fossil fuels and machinery?
Oh, yeah. And if we do a lot of the things that are in the book, folks who are not farmers and ranchers can help out as well. We have lots of ecological restoration that can be done. There's lots of jobs out there potentially for those kinds of works. Anything renewable energy, as we all know about. I mean, there's the potential for a lot of activity, a lot of jobs and paychecks kind of related to this idea of 2% solutions. It's not just about food.
But I think the rest of us could be still carbon grabbers if we demanded carbon capture from the food we buy. I mean, wouldn't it be great, Courtney, to see labels saying how much greenhouse gas was either added or subtracted by the product you're about to buy?
Yeah, and that's actually a very important part of the puzzle here. And I know folks are working on this. There's some complications about how to quantify and measure soil carbon, but they're figuring that out. And we know what the practices are that do this work. So when we can kind of connect those dots, you'll start to see some kind of labeling certification type process to let the consumer, the eater or the energy user, know what the farmer ranch is doing in terms of carbon capture and sequestration in soils.
What do you think of Alan Savory's claims of returning carbon to the soil by raising meat animals differently?
Well, yeah. So I have a chapter, I have a couple profiles in the book that look at ranching and cattle and the regenerative agriculture kind of through the lens of grazing practices. And, we've known Alan for many years. A lot of the ranchers we work with use some variation on the principles that he thought of first way back when. And this is the idea to graze domesticated animals in patterns or behavior that mimic nature, the way that nature wants grazing animals to move and herd and bunch up and move along. And there's an old saying in organic agriculture that nature never farms without animals, which is, I think, a really great way of looking at this. So in nature, there are herbivores grazing and going. So they graze and they go. That's bison, antelope, pronghorn, even rabbits and, everything. So Alan Savory came up with the very smart insight that if we patterned domesticated herbivores, cows in this case, sheep or goats, on patterns of behavior that mimic nature, graze and go, this will be good for the land, good for grass, good for plant vigor, roots going down, carbon being sequestered. And over 40 years, he and the ranchers who use a lot of his ideas have demonstrated these systems work. And I've seen that firsthand. So fundamentally, we can store carbon in soils by getting grass, rangelands, grasslands, healthier, more vigorous, with deeper roots, and then a lot of carbon through photosynthesis goes down through those grass plants and into the soil. So that's a long answer to your question, which is that he's right.
Well, one of the concerns I have is how long does carbon stay in grassland soil? Is it a good long-term solution, or is it a fast, shorter-term fix?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and it's just a little bit complicated. If you dug a hole into a lawn or a grasslands, right at the very top of where the grass plants are, there's a lot of biological activity, a lot of microbes and nematodes and all that kind of stuff. And the carbon cycle at that point is very active, so a lot of carbon is going out of plants into that layer. But microbes digest carbon and they burp CO2. It's called respiration. So that cycle is quick, and you can get a lot of CO2 coming out of microbes as a consequence. But farther down the profile, the deeper the hole that you dug and farther down you go, there's less microbial activity. So if you can get plants to put roots down and then the carbon comes out of the roots into the soil, it's kind of a complicated process, that storage is much longer term. In fact, the farther down that profile you go, you can get hundreds of years of storage as long as we don't disturb that soil, as long as it's not plowed, for example, turned over. So there's not a lot of carbon storage in the top layer. But farther down, there's potentially a lot of storage for long periods of time. And that's our chore, is to get that carbon down that plant by making the plant happy, right? So it's got water, it's got sunlight, it's got good soils, so it grows. And as it grows, it puts deeper roots down past that active layer at the top. So it's a little complicated, but it's the bottom line is, let's have happy, healthy, green plants doing our carbon sequestration for us.
Well, you went way beyond ranching when you got this new book out, and you write about edible forests, for example, and aquaponics. It got me wondering, did you go out and find people who are actually doing this successfully?
And some of the stories I knew, some of the stories I heard as I traveled about, some of the stories I researched, having read about them in other contexts. And for your listeners, the book looks at 50 different profiles, or 50 different ways of producing food or water regeneratively. So they all have a kind of a climate connection, but they do it in lots of different ways. So there's a section on farming, a section on ranching, there's a section in the middle on technology, meaning appropriate technology for this, and there's a section on ecological restoration, and then finally on wildness, on wild animals, because I'm a conservationist by background, and I don't want to leave wild animals out of this. It can't be about agriculture all the time. So I knew some of those stories. Some I'd heard about. I had to go sit down and research, like dung beetles. I'd heard about dung beetles, that the power of the dung beetle in ecosystems. But until I sat down and did a lot of research about dung beetles, I didn't know the details.
What is FarmHack, and could our listeners get involved?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. FarmHack was started by a group of farmers in New Hampshire, led by Doran Cox, who's a farmer near Lee, New Hampshire. And Doran is a very interesting... He's in Grass Soil Hope, which is the carbon book that I wrote. He left the farm. He went into software, into tech, learned all about that, came back to the farm, and decided that they wanted to create a forum, an online forum for new ranchers and farmers to talk to each other. It's kind of a virtual cafe. They call it Farm Hack, and hacking being a common term in the software universe. And the idea is that it's a forum, so folks can kind of log on, ask questions. And he was trying to help young farmers not have to reinvent the wheel every time when they start farming, but also any farmer that's got a question, there's a face-to-face part of this. They have workshops, they meet up and do things, but it's a way of sharing. It's open source, the whole kind of open source commons idea. Let's share information. Let's don't make it proprietary. And so anybody who's listening, is interested, can certainly log on. Go to farmhack.net, I think it is, and you got to create an account and go on. But it's the wonderful thing about the Internet is that, you know, it's an open book, so to speak, for anybody who wants to participate. And this is a good example of how new technology serves old technology. So in this case, organic farming meets the Internet.
And tell us just about a couple of climate-friendly or planet friendly solutions you found in other countries.
Yeah, you bet. One, for example, that I mentioned in Grass Soil Hope, was this research project in France done by some French scientists where they put solar panels above farm fields. And what they're trying to do is, and Europe has a lot of space issues. You know, they need to be very efficient about how they produce food and energy. In this case, the scientists said, let's produce renewable energy and healthy food from the same plot of land. And so they put these solar panels above these farm fields and then did all the calculations to make sure that they could maximize energy production while producing healthy food. And there's that's a very good example of how new technology can meet old technology, and it shades the plants for on hot days and all those kinds of things. And I thought, what a cool idea. And that's an example from France. There's a lot going on in Australia. I talk about pasture cropping, which is a way of growing a annual crop in a perennial pasture, like oats in a grassland, which comes from Australia. Another farmer down there puts his cattle and his sheep together into one unit. Usually they're kept apart, sheep and cows kept apart. In this case, he put them together. He likes the way they graze together. Their impact, he calls it a flurd, a herd and a flock together, called a flurd. And this is very unusual. not many farmers or ranchers are willing to combine sheep and cattle together. So those are three examples from overseas. I just picked 50, and there's a lot more out there. A lot of stuff going on, a lot of innovation, which is, I think, very exciting.
This is Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the Kivira Coalition, Courtney White. Courtney, what does Kivira mean?
So Kivira is an old Spanish colonial word to describe unknown territory. So I live in New Mexico, and when the Spanish came exploring way back when, Kivira was the word that they wrote on the maps. It just meant unknown territory over the hill. And when I started Kivira, with a rancher and another conservationist trying to find common ground between ranchers and environmentalists, we felt like we were heading off into this unknown territory, so we decided to use Kivira. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just a name the Spanish wrote on their maps for land beyond the horizon.
It's a beautiful word. I'm going to use it. So now, your title, 2% Solutions, it has two other meanings. First of all, talk to us about the 2% of carbon that needs to go back to the soil.
Right, yeah. So if anybody who's listening is a gardener, you know that the soil in your garden, that dark, rich soil that is productive and healthy, most of that's carbon, a lot of it's carbon, the element, C. And it doesn't need a lot of carbon. So a lot of land has 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% carbon is in the soils. So the 2% solution here is if we could double the soil carbon from 2% to 4%, or just add 2% to the soil, all of these benefits flow. So it's it holds more water, plants are more productive, and that kind of stuff. For just a little bit of carbon, you get all of this benefit done by 2% of the population, which is farmers and ranchers, for only 2% of the GDP. And that's just a number I grabbed because the point is that these practices described in the book are very cheap, by and large. It doesn't require a lot of money. So for a little bit of money, for a little bit of carbon done by a few people, you can have tremendous benefits for climate, for food, for water, for jobs, all kind of wrapped up in this regenerative agriculture that is going on right now.
Okay, let's say a country decides as national policy to develop carbon-friendly agriculture. There's going to be some economic dislocation as current producers perhaps lose share and new ways of farming are brought up to scale. How can we pay for that and how much would it cost?
Yeah, those are good questions. We have an industrial food system that depletes carbon, doesn't add carbon. So getting farmers and ranchers paid for increasing or storing more carbon would require kind of a rethinking of our economic system. I'm not sure that it would displace many farmers and ranchers, at least not folks that I know. So if you get them to change their practices to regenerative instead of degenerative agriculture. The question is, how do you pay them? They would get a benefit from productivity, in their land, but ultimately we're going to have to figure out some sort of carbon payment system. It'd be nice to have it linked to a carbon tax, meaning that we tax carbon that we burn, that pool of money, which would help us reduce emissions. That amount of money could be available for farmers and ranchers and other folks to increase carbon in soils. So there's a nice link there. Create a pot of money, spend it to pay ranchers and farmers to do more. It's not hard to measure. So I fantasize someday that we have a system that would pay folks. You could measure it. Double the soil carbon, you get paid for it somehow. More dislocation in mentally, in our paradigms, how we look at the world than anything else. We'd have to probably do away with feedlots and all that terrible stuff, but that's okay in the long run. So the point of the book is that these practices exist. They've been out there for a while. They've been beta tested. They're practical. They're profitable. We don't have to invent anything. We don't have to wait for new technology. It's already. But as you say, we need to figure out how to pay the landowner and the manager to do this work.
Of course, you've mentioned the awful word tax, and the conservatives will object to subsidizing carbon capture in agriculture. But isn't every major food producing country already pouring vast amounts into agricultural subsidies?
Oh yeah, and yeah, absolutely. And so the tax question, I understand. I mean, nobody wants their taxes raised. Things cost enough as it is. But we have a system that's taking us in a dangerous direction, and climate and carbon pollution. And at some point, we're going to have to figure this out. And I don't know if tax is the right word, or if you do it through credits, or what. But we have to figure out a way to get that carbon economy going. And to say that we can't raise taxes, well, I understand, but then where does that money come from, at least initially, until we start paying for more stuff? So that's beyond my pay grade, in terms of how to make this work at the kind of the tax policy level. But I just know that the practices are there. They've been vetted. They exist. They produce all these benefits, food, water, healthy animals, open space protection. It's a win-win-win-win-win all the way down the line. If it means that we pay more, either through the cost of services, the food, or through a tax thing, and it seems to me at this point we got to bite that bullet in order to get the world that we want.
Well, we might save the $60 billion we're going to have to pay every time New York gets hit by yet another storm and rising seas. So look, in your book, you have a great story about a farmer who became dejected about his role in harming the planet. Just tell us briefly about that, would you?
Yeah, you bet. His name is John Gosney. He lives in Oklahoma. I went out there to see a very innovative model of food distribution called the Oklahoma Food Cooperative. And it's an internet-based way to buy food across Oklahoma. And this is a challenge for farmers and ranchers that are remote. How do they get to markets? And it was a very cool way of kind of linking eaters to producers. But he was part of the tour, and I went to his ranch, and he told this amazing story. He'd been a chemical farmer, meaning he'd farmed, raised his cattle and done his sheep with lots of pesticides and chemicals and things. And he didn't feel well. He knew it was bad for the land, and he frankly had just gotten depressed. And he told the group that his life changed entirely when a neighbor who wanted to retire asked him to take over their organic wheat farm. And he had not thought about this, and he was resistant, and he said okay. And he went and he studied it and realized it was a good idea. So he converted his farm to organic, which means they got rid of all the chemicals. He felt better physically, and as he told the group I was with, he felt like he was doing God's work now after all this time. And he was a farmer to the bone, and he loves the land, but he wants it to be healthy, not depleting. And that's what happened to him. He got excited again converting to an organic farm, and his depression went away, and he had motivated again, and he really felt like he was a new person. It was a very moving story that I've heard other farmers and ranchers explain, like get off pesticides, get on to healthy practices, good for people and land. they feel better.
It's like getting off heroin almost.
Yeah, you know, and of course now they have a lot of science behind all this stuff, meaning that they know what these pesticides are doing to us, and from kids and embryos on up to adults, this stuff is toxic, and it's toxic on a lot of levels. And now, is you know, if finally we're seeing a lot of the kind of research come out and say, even in small amounts, this stuff. So then this stuff goes into the food, and if you eat industrial wheat, it goes into you. There's an old saying, if it's in the feed, it's in the food, meaning it's in you. So your listeners, I mean, the way to try to support all this is to ask careful questions about what you eat. Where is it from? What's in it? Could you eat from a farm or a ranch that is carbon friendly? But not just organic, but is it doing, you know, energy things, carbon things? There's not a lot out there. There's more than there used to be, but there's more on the way.
Can you talk to us about any recent conferences or organizations that inspire you?
Well, yes. And what's sort of amazing about the last 3, 4, 5 years is that there's a lot more conferences, a lot more ways to go and learn about this. I don't go back east a lot. There's a lot of conferences out here. There was a conference in California just in September called Soil, Not Oil. It drew a lot of people. Again, the idea that let's think about soil, let's get off oil. There's an annual Bioneers conference in San Francisco in October. It's in its 26th year. It's a great place to go learn about these alternatives. There's lots of ecological farming conferences. There's one in February called Moses in Wisconsin. I know there's a lot of stuff back east. Stone Barns in New York has a big conference. I think if listeners are interested, just Google Ecological Agriculture Conference and see what comes up.
As we wrap up, is there anything I've missed or a final message you would like to leave, particularly with our city listeners?
So there's two messages. One, why I wrote the book is I want folks to feel like there's an alternative to our current food and energy systems. You know, we got the industry is controlled by the big boys, the big dogs, that don't want us to know that organic and regenerative agriculture can answer our problems. This was a way of kind of showing that we can. And number two is an antidote to despair. There are big problems out there. We tend to get gloomy about our prospects. I wanted folks to know that there are things on the ground that can be done right now. And listeners who live in the city, I would encourage them just to seek them out. I mean, there's a story about a rooftop farm in Brooklyn, and energy and watershed stuff. And these things can happen almost anywhere around you. Just kind of dig a little bit and see where you can participate.
We've been talking with Courtney White. He dropped out of the Sierra Club as a conflict industry to found the nonprofit Kivira Coalition, which is dedicated to bringing together many players for planetary solutions. You can find out more at kiviracoalition.org, and that is spelled Q-U-I-V-I-R-A. I'll also put links to Courtney's new book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. The subtitle is 50 Low-Cost, Low-Tech, Nature-Based Practices for Combating Hunger, Drought, and Climate Change. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock.
Appreciate it, Alex, and thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.